I'm just gonna sleep. You're running the show.
Yeah.
I wanna see how you do this. I told him federally, I said, you know, if they're doing the orientation, I said, if you wanna see a real dysfunctional committee, come down to 15.
Well, that was good.
Before and after, huh?
Yeah. And then when it's like I used to run the county commission.
You gotta be nice to take that gavel and bang me on the elbow if I go to sleep, cause I came through here last night and got home in time to get 5 hours of sleep and turn around and get back up and come back.
Alright.
Just make sure Nancy is where you're gonna gavel, cause you gotta sneak everything out.
Go hot, huh?
And.
She's okay.
Okay.
Good morning. That was good. It's, November 12th, 2002. Hereby call to order the Joint Health and Human Resources Committee meeting. Good morning to everyone. Welcome. We have a real full slate to cover today, so we'll get right at it. Senator-elect and Representative Winters will not be present today, and Senator Tro will be just a little late in getting here. So we'll start off with agenda item number one, which is a report from the Oregon Dental Association Work Group on Ownership. We could have Richard Asai and Mr. Shercliffe come forward, and they already are. So good morning, gentlemen, and welcome. Great.
Chairman Girard, Senator Fisher, other members of the committee, thank you for inviting us back. We met with you briefly in January, and we're charged with a meeting. I have a couple of distributed.
Could you pull the mic a little closer?
Sure.
And you do need to identify yourself too, please.
I wouldn't think so.
I'm Dr. Rick Asai, dental dentist from Beaverton, and been asked to give a report on our ownership work group. Just a brief history. In 2001, the regular session, Senator Fisher and the Oregon Dental Association brought forth Senate Bill 105, which I believe you have a copy that was distributed earlier, that would have made an exemption for temporary ownership of a dental practice by a surviving spouse or certain representatives of deceased or disabled dentists. The bill was not enacted because of disagreement over amendments. In September 21, 2001, the Attorney General issued an opinion. At the request of the Board of Dentistry, an opinion from the Attorney General's office was made in an attempt to clarify the current ownership statute. Among the questions addressed was the use of practice management businesses by dentists. The AG left the issue cloudy. For example, in the copy of that opinion that you have, on page 2, about the fourth line, under the question number 3, may a licensed dentist use the services of a practice management business? The opinion states, yes, a licensed dentist may use services offered by a practice management business for the business operations of a dental office, so long as the practice management business limits its activities to clerical and administrative functions that do not involve the exercise of discretionary decision-making that would rise to the level of engaging, conducting, operating, or maintaining a dental office. That seems pretty straightforward. But on the next page, the opinion continues, quote, ORS 679.0201 prohibits the practice of dentistry without a license issued by the board, while ORS 679.0202 requires that an individual obtain such a license before engaging, conducting, operating, or maintaining any dental office in any way. Later on, it goes on, we conclude, therefore, that the legislature intended for the phrase engaging, conducting, operating, or maintaining any dental office to refer to activities other than those that comprise the clinical practice of dentistry. This conclusion is supported by case law. So one of the goals of the work group was to make it clear what activities are acceptable and should not be considered violations of the law. It also wanted to make it perfectly clear that dental clinics that provide services through local governments, educational facilities, federally qualified health centers, and charities are within the law. The 2002 interim. During the legislative interim, the Oregon Dental Association, at the request of both the Board of Dentistry and this committee, conducted a work group on the ownership of dental practices. dental interests were invited to participate with the goal of developing a consensus on legislation that all parties could support in 2003. It was agreed that one of our priorities would be to address those points in the Attorney General's opinion so that groups like Kaiser Permanente, Permanente Dental Associates, and Willamette Dental Group would be able to continue to operate within the letter of the law. We also wanted to specifically allow the surviving spouse to administer a dental practice until it could be sold or transferred. In our discussions, we realized that there were gaps in the Dental Practice Act with regards to ownership of clinics at the dental school, local governments, training institutions for dental auxiliaries, nonprofits formed to provide services to migrants and the homeless, and nonprofits such as Northwest Medical Team's Dental Band. I'm pleased to report to you this morning that we have reached consensus in all of these areas. The participants included myself as chair of the work group, Dr. Wendell, ODA president last year, Jane Myers, our staff, Dr. Ron Short, representative of the Oregon Board of Dentistry, Rick Verkobian, your committee administrator, Dr. Gordon Ampey, Multnomah County Dental Services, Dr. Carl Perkins from OHSU Dental School, Dr. Mike Shirtcliffe from Northwest Dental Service, Dr. Gene Skurdes from Willamette Dental Group, DenCor, and along with him, Steve Prezzelli, Russ House, and Jen Chin from DenCor, Barney Spate, Kaiser Northwest Foundation Health Plan, Don Krasnikar, Permanente Dental Associates, Dr. Steve Duffin, Interdent Capital Dental Managed Care, along with Hart Laws and Barbara May, Dr. Stephen Thurn, Whitebird Dental Clinic in Lane County, Mr. Dick Rowan, Northwest Medical Teams, and along with him, Dr. Kent Zare, and Dr. Paul Kunkel with the Oregon Dental Foundation. The consensus agreement was to exceptions to ownership of dental practices. They include, and we agreed on, allowing or suggesting that OHSU School of Dentistry, local governments, institutions or programs accredited by the Commission on Dental Accreditation of the American Dental Association to provide education and training, nonprofit Oregon corporations formed under Oregon law to provide dental services to migrant, community, or homeless under 42 U.S.C. Section 254B or 254C, or a federally qualified health center under 42 U.S.C. Section 139-102B, as long as it is in compliance with state and federal law. The surviving spouse of a dentist owner or the personal representative of a deceased or incapacitated dentist owner for a period of 12 months from the date of death, the Board of Dentistry being allowed to extend the time for reasonable requests. And then also nonprofit charitable corporations organized under 26 U.S.C. Section 501C3 as determined by the Board of Dentistry to provide volunteer dental services for no fee or a substantially reduced fee to populations with limited access to care. I would remind you that the statute already allows labor organizations to own and operate dental clinics. We came up with some conditions that would need to be met to satisfy our goals of protecting the service to the dental patients in the sense that all entities must have an actively licensed dentist named as the dental director, and that the dental director be responsible for appropriate oversight of diagnosis, prescriptions, treatment plan of all dental patients. Quality of care and supervision of hygienists, assistants are also the responsibility of the dental director. Another area that was unclear was what sorts of, as I alluded to earlier in the Attorney General's opinion, what sorts of activities could or could not be delegated to non-dentist entities. And we would suggest that nothing in the statute preclude any person or entity not licensed by the board from ownership or leasehold of any tangible or intangible assets used in a dental office or clinic, including real property, furnishings, equipment, and inventory. This does not include the patient dental records relating to clinical care, commonly referred to as dental charts, patient charts. We'd also would suggest that employment or contracting of personnel, with the exception of licensed dentists, also be allowed. If such employment or contracting includes dental hygienists, or dental assistants or other personnel involved in direct patient care, the person or entity shall comply with the dental director requirements. And then also that management of business aspects of a clinic or office, but not including the clinical practice of dentistry or the delivery of patient care. In the final area, where there was some discussion we did not reach consensus was allowing non-dentist ownership of a dental practice. we agreed to disagree and to answer any questions you may have about that. In rough numbers of the groups that were represented, it was equally divided, pretty equally divided, either neutral for or against that concept of non-deficit ownership. And if you would allow me, I'd like to briefly address 4 points on why some of the arguments against non-deficit ownership at this time. Thank you. No gain to patient protection was advanced. The current statute is designed to protect the patient-dentist relationship. The restriction to ownership by licensed dentists protects professional judgment from undue influence. This assures decisions are made in the patient's best interests. The Board of Dentistry only has jurisdiction over dentists and hygienists. It has no reach to discipline a corporation that may interfere with the exercise of professional judgment. Furthermore, the Board of Dentistry is entirely funded by fees paid by licensees. Dentists certainly have a larger stake in the cost of board operations, while the proponent businesses do not. During the work group meetings, it was made clear that the proponents of non-dentist ownership would not support the extension of the board's enforcement authority, either in policy or financial funding. A few states have extended non-dentist ownership, but they have also balanced it with stringent enforcement fines and criminal penalties. The legislature doesn't have to go that far, though, because the consensus agreement adds acceptable business activities that can be done by any entity, licensed or not. Another argument is to make dental practice ownership consistent with medical practice ownership statute that do not take into account the balances that have been created in law to help rebalance the patient's interest in unfettered professional judgment. The legislature over time has created several statutes that give medical patients and physicians protection from medical plans. Dental patients and dentists have been expressly excluded from these statutes. The current ownership law is the only statutory protection for the dentist-patient relationship at this time. Examples are ORS 743, the prompt pay and assignment of payment. We would note also that Congress has failed to enact any patient protection legislation covering either dental or medical patients. And we find that it is significant to point out that lawyers are not allowed to conduct the practice of law with partners who are not licensed lawyers. So there are some inconsistencies regulating the various professions. The argument has also been made that there are some dental practices in Oregon that already have non-dentist ownership. We do not agree that a change needs to be made to accommodate arrangements with non-dentists who own part of the practice already. Frankly, there are two public policies involved here. We do not support encouraging either dentists to flaunt the law for tax advantages or lawyers to flaunt the law or be ignorant of the law to the detriment of their clients. Opening the door to ownership doesn't open the door to access. In fact, the opposite is probably more likely. Investors expect a rate of return, which will tend to raise the cost of doing business. Increased fees make it harder for people to obtain dental care. Also, the management activities we discussed should take care of many of these issues by allowing outside entities to own assets, employ staff, except dentists, or manage business portions of a dental practice, as long as it does not interfere with the clinical practice of dentistry. I want to publicly thank those who participated in the work group, whether they are present today or not. I also want to thank this committee for allowing us to the opportunity to work this out in the interim, and we are all interested in promoting the best dental care for our patients. I believe that we have agreed to a consensus of legislative concepts that will allow all parties concerned to continue to practice dentistry and deliver quality dental care without the fear of practicing outside of the dental practice statute. For these reasons, I believe that the consensus is a huge success. And I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Committee, have any questions for Dr. Asok? Okay. Representative Cruz.
I guess I would like a little more. It appears that virtually everything, there's consensus on virtually everything except the real point. So to a degree here, I guess, and you were talking about dentists shouldn't be able to flaunt the law, and I agree with that. They should, what they do should be within the law. But I what it comes down to, I guess, for me is if there could be a change in the law to allow a small dental operation to get a better tax rate and it doesn't jeopardize patient safety in any way or access in any way, it seems like that's something certainly worth considering. And so I guess what I'm wondering is if there... What you weren't able to do, I guess, as a group was come to a point where you could allow dentists to reach that IRS classification without alleviating the concerns over access. Is that basically what I'm hearing?
I think the concern was that it's that the board only has oversight over licensees and only has the ability to admonish or have, you know, follow up on care delivered by licensees. So non-dentist owners, there's no oversight in place now. So you'd have to create some additional administrative bureaucracy or whatever to ensure that there isn't any possibility of undue influence by non-dentist owners.
Mr. Chair?
One more question, Mike, and then what percent of outside ownership would be required to satisfy IRS code?
Well, my understanding is it's 6%.
Okay.
It depends on the volume of the dollars in the practice, and there's some debate about that, but it's around 6 to 10%. I'm here, Mr. Chair, to speak about the other side on the minority position.
Hang on just a second, Mike.
Okay. Well, I mean, I guess... And clearly, if I invest in a corporation, if I buy stock in a corporation, I'm doing so assuming a return. But, you know, I own stock in corporations such as Microsoft, okay? I don't think that my desire for a large return is going to make any determination on their plan of business, you know, because I'm not, you know, if I own 40% of their stock, maybe. You know, maybe they'd listen to me. The amount of stock I own, well, actually, if I would have invested that amount in their stock 30 years ago, I'd be incredibly rich. But, you know, so I guess my point is, if we're talking at 6 to 10%, that's not a controlling interest. And so I guess I'm just a little confused over what the real issue is here, because I can't see where 6 to 10%, ownership, if we could cap it just to satisfy the code, if we've really set up a negative situation. I did, you know, I'm asking, I don't know.
Dr. Cliff, if you'd like to add your...
I'm here to...
If you'd identify yourself.
Yeah, well, I'm Dr. Mike Shercliff. I'm President and CEO of Northwest Dental Service, headquartered in Roseburg. I represent 270 dentists across 20 rural counties. Thank you for the opportunity to speak, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. When we started this whole process, there are a lot of people that are practicing presently outside the law. I compete in rural Oregon with safety net clinics that have no dentists, nonprofit organizations which own dental clinics, which are subsidized by the federal government. Not only in fact, there's Representative Girard, there's one in your town, that is subsidized by the federal government. The employees, dentists there are subsidized by the federal government, and my dentists have to compete with those clinics, and they're truthfully outside the law. I also have to compete with Kaiser Permanente, which is also practicing, depending upon your interpretation of the Attorney General's opinion, outside the law. Also, Northwest Medical Teams, which I donate time each month to, because I think it's a worthy endeavor. I go down and help citizens who can't afford it. The first Tuesday of every month down at the one of the local organizations in Roseburg, I go down the first Tuesday of every month and spend a day taking care of citizens who can't afford dental care. And they're operating outside the law. I have 270 dentists, of which approximately half of them have minority ownership advice by their attorneys, so they can get a 20% tax break on their corporations from 35 to 15%, which are operating outside the Attorney General's opinion, anyway, of the law. And when we went through this whole process, one of the objectives is how do we make it so that all stakeholders in dentistry and all delivery systems can practice within the law, and also have the Board of Dentistry supervising those dentists so that the citizens of Oregon's dental health can be protected. And the way what we tried to do was set out so that that could continue and all the different business models in Oregon could continue to practice within the law. And the only one we couldn't agree upon was dentists who have to pay taxes having the ability to raise capital and get a tax break in their corporations. Because truthfully, this is about corporations having tax breaks and the ability to raise capital to develop delivery systems that allow dentistry to be prevented in the state of Oregon. In the old days, not too distant past, I shouldn't say that, I'm going to be 59 here pretty soon, but in the old days, we just had dentists practicing in solo practices. We didn't have corporations practicing dentistry, and so the practice of dentistry kind of outstripped the Dental Practice Act. And the Board of Dentistry, one piece we didn't talk about, the Board of Dentistry would like the law updated in regards to the Attorney General's opinion so that they can then begin to go out and enforce the law as it's presented. So we had a debate about, is it going to be 6%, 10%? The corporation would like to see it 49% so that they could then raise capital, create ownership in their staffs by allowing the staff to have ownership in the practice in all those debates. And what we actually compromised on was 25%. Now, the fear is that if we open up the door and let any non-dentist ownership of that, what will happen is the companies, the managed care companies and the corporate dental companies will come back and then continually increase the ownership level until such time that non-dentists will be in charge. And so where is that balance between providing a tax break for the individual, allowing corporate dental companies to raise capital, and preserving the traditional concept of who controls dentistry in the dentist's hands? And that was the debate. Now, everybody around the table was either neutral or agreed with 25%. The Dental Association doesn't agree with that, and what they voted at their House of Delegates meeting, by the way, of which I testified at their hearing about that, and I'm a member in good standing of the Dental Association, what they agreed upon is no ownership. Because of their fear, if they open up the door, then you let the fox in the hen house, is he going to get the chickens who are in there? And I think our position is that all the stakeholders around the table should have their issues addressed so that we can go forward in dentistry with a position that allows us to serve the needs of our citizens, allows the development and support of all delivery systems that are out there, and allows us to do that, like the Representative Cruz said, in a way that allows us to take advantage of, like every other corporation in Oregon, of a 20% tax break.
Representative Bates.
Mr. Chair, I have several questions for Dr. Shurtcliffe, if I could, for a few moments, because I'm a little confused in this also. I'm going to try to clear it in my own mind through a few questions, if I could. In your opinion, Doctor, is it a greater problem in Oregon for citizens to access dental care, or is there a greater problem with quality of that care?
Access.
Well, that's my sense, too.
Access to care is not quality of care.
Quality of care is excellent, but access is a real difficult thing for many Oregonians.
That's true.
And we're underserved for a lot of reasons, lack of dentists and a lack of the ability for people to access this because of pay. Would you
the traditional model that we have developed, we had to go out, our company itself, as you know, Representative Bates, has developed a model that is a dental cooperative. And we've had to develop that around the present Dental Practice Act so we can do it legally and provide that access to care. And it's difficult to do and cumbersome. And in rural Oregon, every dollar a dentist can save in taxes or whatever allows him to be able to deliver affordable dental care and remain, very frankly, in that practice in rural Oregon.
Doctor, is it follow-up?
Follow-up.
Doctor, to make this simple, do you think there's a fear that dentists and individual practices have that corporations will come in and take their practices out? Basically,
that's
the competition will wipe them out.
That's
the real
point.
Fear we have here.
That's right. Yeah, the other fear is the fact that there's this ongoing debate in dentistry that if you're a corporate model, you can't deliver the quality at the level that you can in the fee-for-service model. And you're familiar with that, Dr. Bates, because that's the old debate that went on in the physicians also. And so that is a fear also.
And just again, a follow-up question to make sure it's clear in my mind what we're talking about here. 20 or 30 or 40 years ago, physicians all had private practices. Now it was a mixture. There's some private practices, but there's groups like Kaiser and the Providence Health Group and others that have gone to corporate ownership and still practice what we consider excellent medicine.
Mm-hmm.
Some would say with better access, some would say maybe not. But that's an option that patients have to choose if they want to go to a corporate management group or they want to go to a private physician. Is this a parallel track, Ronnie, with dentists, or is it completely separate from what the physician does?
No, it's my, in my opinion, it's a parallel track.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair.
Senator Fisher.
Yeah, I have a couple questions. I like this 20% tax break explained to me. I'm missing something here. Why does it involve outside ownership?
Because there are corporate Wall Street dental companies out there that if you're an individual dentist, it's like the mom-and-pop grocery store who fears competing with Safeway. That's the outside interest on that.
No, but I mean, where does this 20% tax break come in?
It comes in if you're a dental corporation and you have minority ownership in that practice, you then are entitled to a different corporate tax rate. And it goes from 35% to 15%. If you have, it's 6 to 10 or 12%, depending upon the number of dollars that practice generates. And so that's just the tax break that's available under the present tax code that you can't take advantage of under the Attorney General's opinion, because it doesn't allow any minority ownership of a dental corporation.
A follow-up question.
Of a non-dentist ownership. It has to be non-dentist ownership.
When you're talking about a minority ownership, is this minority as in diversity, or is this minority...
The minority of the practice ownership has to be in a... Somebody... the minority in this case is a non-dentist. Could be female, your kids, your grandfather. It could be... whoever has to be the minority in that case is a non-dentist.
Follow up.
I'm sorry. I should have clarified.
No, I just have not been aware of, not being involved myself in a professional dental, or I would guess now is the same thing available to the medical field.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
Or is the same thing available to the medical practice, or?
Correct. Correct.
Okay. So what is the reasoning behind this?
The reason why they don't allow a minority ownership in dental practice?
No, the reason why they give a tax break for a minority ownership.
That's beyond me, Senator Fisher. I don't know why that. I don't know why they would have that particular provision in the tax code to allow that to happen. I do not know.
Okay. I have a couple other questions, if I might. How's the new denturist law going to affect some of this where you're not controlling them through the Board of Dentistry? Are they going to be able to go into, for instance, joint practice with a dentist?
My understanding from the bill is that yes, they can, but that needs to be clarified some. That's my understanding. Yeah.
Okay, I'd like to... ask one further question of Dr. Aeson. On page, I'm guessing it's 5 here.
Be wide open.
No, page 4, right at the top of the page, statement C, management of the business aspects of a dental clinic or office, but not including the clinical practice of dentistry. In my operation of business, if you have, for instance, a controller, and he tells you you're not making enough money, he's basically controlling your practice of dentistry, isn't he? Because he's telling you point blank that you either see more people, or you shorten up something, or you do cheaper work, or you wear a waistcoat instead of a full-length gown, or something like that. I mean, he's going to have some effect on it if he's doing any function. If not, maybe you ought to get rid of him and thereby make your practice more profitable. But I had a hard time seeing how you can limit outside influence or non-professional influence in the management of the business aspects of a dental clinic without allowing them some type of latitude in controlling what's done.
Well, we would share your concern that, and in our discussions, we wanted to try to help the Board of Dentistry differentiate, you know, the clinical practice of dentistry and those decisions that are made cooperatively between the dentist and their patients, that truly nothing does interfere with that. And that would be partly probably up to the board, depending on how the statute is structured, to determine when, in fact, that line is crossed. But we would share that concern that, and clearly the line gets fuzzier as you start including more parties. When there's only a dentist and a patient involved, the line is pretty clear. As other entities, particularly non-dentist owners, become involved, that line has the potential to become cloudier, and that would be one of our concerns. If I might, I'd like to respond to a couple things that Dr. Schrickbaum said.
Sure, go ahead.
In his earlier remarks, said something to the effect that Kaiser, their operation, the dental operation, is in violation of the Dental Practice Act. And our feeling is that Kaiser Health Plan has a contract with a dental group, the Permanente Dental Associates, is entirely owned by dentists. And so in the strictest interpretation of the law, we don't feel that they are currently practicing outside of the Dental Practice Act, and neither is Willamette Dental Group. Willamette Dental Group, D.C., the dentists also are entirely owned by dentists right now, and they contract with Denfor, Practice Management and Health Insurance Group. I'm sorry.
In reality, what I was driving at here, anything that limits it, and I guess my premise would be that even the rates the federal government pays for dental service to a certain extent limits your practice of dentistry from the fact of what you can do and still manage to take home enough money to stay afloat. And from that standpoint, I'm not sure whether it'd be more detrimental to have private investment in it or government investment in it.
Well, clearly, I think that's true. I mean, even in with respect to the Oregon Health Plan, on the medical side, we've seen large insurers withdraw because reimbursement rates have been not adequate to cover their costs. And because they have lost money, they have withdrawn from certain areas of the state and certain markets. And certainly that is true. I mean, obviously, there's going to be a balance between what is achievable cost-wise and in terms of the services that are contracted to be delivered.
Mr. Chair, can I have one more comment?
Mr. Chip.
The reference to that there needs to be another layer of bureaucracy to control the quality of care for the citizens in Oregon, I'd like to address that issue because one of the concerns of every stakeholder around the table in this work group was that the Board of Dentistry had the control to monitor and necessary discipline the dentist and his license so that in all of these systems, the Board of Dentistry had control over the dentist. So if I'm a dentist and I go to work for a managed care company, and the managed care company tells me to do something that's not professional, it's outside the Dental Practice Act, if I do that, that's tough the way it is because I'm the dentist, I've got the doctor's degree, I've got the license, and it's my responsibility to make sure that I don't do that. And so one of the things we tried to do is to make sure, and every stakeholder agreed, that the Board of Dentistry had the power to discipline the dentist if he practiced outside the Dental Practice Act, regardless of the delivery system that was there. And that's, at least from our group, we would not have agreed to this compromise if that would not have remained. And very frankly, I think that position is strengthened in this proposed proposal that we're putting forth. And so I feel like that there really doesn't need to be a more layer of bureaucracy. What we've done is strengthen the hand of the bureaucracy that already exists, and regardless of what managed care companies do, the dentist's dental practice license is at risk if he practices in a way outside the scope of the Dental Practice Act. So I feel like we've strengthened that position, and the citizens of Oregon will be served better by this by the legislation of the tone of this compromise.
Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You have to excuse me. I had the fan sound right above me.
I'm sorry.
Is it Dr. Shirtcliff?
Dr. Shirtcliff.
Cliff.
Like a shirt you'd wear and a cliff you'd jump over.
Okay, thanks. Doctor, I want to get back, and you were touching on my question right there. I want to get back to who's actually controlling the operation at any given location. Now, I understood from the argument on page four by Dr. Saya that you folks weren't agreeable to the idea of the Board of Dentistry, who would be licensing the dentist, and then that person, a person who's licensed by the board, would be the dental director. Are you okay with that?
Yes, I support that, sir. I do.
Okay.
I support that, and it needs to be, because an organization like Northwest Medical Teams,
right.
One of the things that make me nervous about practice in that setting is there really is nobody in charge of, this is a dentist that's in charge of, what goes in that, each individual dentist. And so I really support the fact that each entity should have a dental director. Yes, I do.
Could I have a follow-up on that?
Follow-up?
There is always the potential for, you know, my employer is going to tell me what to do, and you just touched on that a minute ago. But I want to ask you a question. Are you agreeable to the idea that if, in fact, we have this dental director who is a licensed dentist by the board, that if they have to make a decision that they believe is in the interest of the patient, and any action is taken against that director, because I'm going to describe them as the director of this clinic, by what I see, is there disciplinary action against the corporation for, in fact, telling the director of the clinic, the dentist, not to do or to do something that they don't agree with?
There would be, under the Dental Practice Act, as it's written and proposed, there wouldn't be action against the corporation. I mean,
is there any mechanism to do that?
There, not under this proposal. No, there is not, sir.
Can I have a follow-up on that?
Follow-up?
Would you be agreeable to allowing that kind of disciplinary action?
I don't disagree with that. No, I do not.
Okay, thanks.
Committee, have any other questions?
Yeah.
Senator Morsette.
Thank you.
Let's go back to reasons why a dentist can't incorporate himself and get the 20% tax break. Could you touch on that one more time?
My understanding from our corporate attorney, who does a lot of professional corporations, in fact, he's that if you are a professional corporation, dental professional corporation, and you have minority ownership, and what most dentists do is they have their, as long as it's not an employee of the corporation, you get a tax break if you have up 6 to 10% ownership by non-dentists in your practice. That gives you a tax break. Why that would happen, I don't have a clue, sir, because I don't have an answer to that.
Follow-up, please.
Follow-up?
Is that a state interpretation or is that a federal?
It's a federal law.
That's a federal law. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
Committee, have any other questions?
Just a comment.
Senator Fisher.
I don't know how many times I've run onto in my business career places where the state interferes with us utilizing some type of break that we get through the federal tax codes. And this has always bothered me because, and especially in the medical arena, we're struggling to do the best we can. We want to give the best job of care, and yet we deny our suppliers and providers the opportunity to take advantage of things that they take advantage of in other states. And I guess this bothers me to a certain extent that we don't have that capability here. And I see a situation here where you're basically telling the dentist that his neck is on the line from either the board or his corporation. If he gets caught in a pinch, he's going to have to quit and look for work elsewhere if he's got the nerve to do it. And I look at other professions, for instance, corporations are not held responsible basically other than through the liability courts and tort aspects of a pilot, for instance, that makes a dumb judgment or something like that, or that they push to overextend his capabilities and fly in weather that he shouldn't and everything. He's the one that, whose license is on the line, and the FAA doesn't worry at all about the corporation. They don't ban the corporation from flying for 90 days or take their license away or anything like that to own an aircraft, but they take away the pilot's opportunity to do business, and the pilot is caught between his job and his life. In reality, you're putting the dentist kind of in the same position, but maybe we're in that same position anyway to a certain extent, because if you weren't working for a corporation, you're working for yourself, there's still a temptation to perhaps short-circuit things a little bit to do just a little bit better in your own private operation or something like that. So it seems like that what we're basically getting to is the willingness and the honesty of the professional person himself more than any other thing here being on the line. And if a corporation operates so badly that they put their people in jeopardy, pretty soon nobody's going to work for them. At least that would be my...
The debate between ethics and the business of professions in any medical, dental, any license where you're working, you have the regulation of the state, and then you have the entrepreneurialism of the American citizens, and you have that ongoing debate that you folks wrestle with it every day. How do you protect the needs of the citizen and also allow for innovation and capital formation, and continually, the thing that really allows that keeps our country above every other country is the fact that we're always out there figuring a better way to do it and do it better. You know, we're the country that went to the moon and back on a spaceship built by the lowest bidder. I mean, that's an oxymoron, but very frankly, how do we allow that same innovation in dentistry? Because very frankly, without it, like Representative Bates said, we won't have access to care. And that's part of what we're having as we increase the regulation. You know, I also have another hat as I'm the president and CEO of Advantage Dental Plan, which is a licensed dental insurance company in the state of Oregon. And I'm here to tell you that the cost of health care, a big piece of it, is the regulations that we keep piling upon what we have to do. And so some place in there is a happy medium where you protect the citizens and where you allow the expansion of the quality of care that we need. So, yeah, this is a debate we had. We debated in dentistry all the time. I would hate to see this was, to me, this was a good process. We compromised on everything except for this, and I think that we actually compromised on it, everybody around the table except for the Dental Association, and I think that somewhere in there should be allow the innovation that you're talking about, Senator Fisher.
Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chertoff, I'm going to ask you to comment on page 5 of Dr. Sayas' comments, item 2, the bottom of that paragraph. He makes this statement: the current ownership law is the only statutory protection for the dentist-patient relationship at this time.
That's not true. You've got all the business laws that go on top of it. You know, you've got the corporation division, you've got, you know, the Better Business Bureau, you've got all of those other regulations that we get regulated by, too, because we are businesses and small businesses. And as you know, we've got OSHA, we've got, now we've got HIPAA, and I mean, I can't, the acronyms that we have out there to deal with are, I mean, they're monumental. And we're trying to figure out how we're going to deal with this new Privacy Act that you got up, the Security Act. And how is we as small businessmen going to deal with all that stuff and provide this perfect product without the ability to raise capital in our companies to be able to do that and to do it in a way that is affordable? Without some innovation, you're absolutely correct. We've got the pile of regulation, plus the Dental Practice Act, plus all the other stuff that, you know, if you pass a patient protection bill, well, then we got to pile that on top of that, too, and so the pile just gets taller and taller. So, yeah, there's lots of regulations, sir.
Mr. Chairman, just to comment on that, now that agriculture is under OSHA, we have been dealing with making sure that we're in total compliance, and one of the things we found out is we have a 32-page description on how to put a dust mask on your face. So I do sympathize with the fact that you probably have a lot of
manuals about this thing.
Right, thank you.
Any other further questions from the committee? Seeing none, Chair, thanks.
Thank you, sir.
Both of you gentlemen, you, for your testimony this morning.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Our next item on the agenda is Grover Simmons. And Mr. Simmons has some additional folks. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Grover Simmons. I represent the Adult Care Providers Association of Oregon. This is a statewide trade association of adult foster homes. And as you know, these homes are private residences that take up to five frail or elderly Oregonians and provide care for them on a 24-hour basis. There are about 1,800 adult foster homes in Oregon, but only a few hundred of them belong to the association. And these homes are part of the state's community-based care system. And Mr. Gary Lane on my left here will testify as to some of the problems with liability insurance which these homes are experiencing. Another part of the community-based care system includes residential care facilities, which are much larger than foster homes. And Mr. Harry Geislinger on my right will testify about what's happening to RCFs regarding insurance coverage. Your committee has been studying liability insurance for several months, and in September you took testimony about physicians' professional liability coverage, plus insurance for hospitals, and finally the impact of increased liability rates on nursing homes. The common denominator in all of that testimony was that some doctors are giving up their practice, some hospital clinics are closing, and some nursing homes are severely impacted by ever-increasing insurance rates. The goal of our testimony today is to make the point that adult foster homes and residential care facilities, the less influential end of the caregiving spectrum, if you will, are also suffering from what is taking place in the liability insurance field. More and more cases, liability insurance is not being renewed. That is, it's just simply not available. And in those homes and facilities which are, in fact, being offered a policy, the price is astronomical and unaffordable. These situations pose a serious threat that many foster homes and RCFs will close. If the price of insurance is unaffordable, going without or going bare is equally unpalatable and an imprudent business practice. Providers are truly up a tree, and they don't know what to do at this point. In addition to the price issue, however, two other factual situations threaten the future of community-based care program. First, insurance companies are now saying that if your foster home has a resident with mental illness or plans to accept such a resident in the future, you're disqualified from purchasing liability insurance. Secondly, if you have a mixed resident population in your home, that is, both men and women in your care, or you take young people as well as older residents, liability insurance will not be renewed. The insurance companies which are taking these positions may well be subjecting themselves to lawsuits for a violation of the Americans with Disability Act or the Fair Housing Law. Kathy Wild, an attorney with the Oregon Advocacy Center, is researching the feasibility of just such a lawsuit based on the theory of illegal discrimination. I brought these various problems to the attention of the Insurance Division of the Consumer and Business Services Department. I pointed out that according to the Oregon Blue Book, the division's duties and responsibilities include assuring, quote, the availability and affordability of insurance and the fair treatment of policyholders, close quote. They're supposed to investigate consumer complaints against insurance companies as well as license these companies and provide insurance products. I won't say the insurance division was completely indifferent to what's going on, but neither did they show much interest in doing anything about it. That concludes my prepared testimony, but I want to mention this morning at 10 minutes till 7, I got a phone call from my daughter in Bend, who teaches nursing at the community college. And she knew that I was going to be here today and talk about liability insurance, and particularly this mental illness issue, because she has a advanced degree in psychosocial nursing. That's kind of her specialty. She pointed out to me that in 1996, the United States Congress passed a law prohibiting or saying you couldn't discriminate against mental illness people with respect to health care. And she wasn't sure if that law was still on the books, and she was pretty sure that it was not being aggressively implemented. So I don't know the history of that, and I'll look into it, but this issue of not being able to buy liability insurance if you take care of mentally ill residents is a major issue. And I'd like Mr. Gary Lane to tell what happened to him in his adult foster home.
Hi, I'm Gary Lane. I take care of adult schizophrenics in my home, 5 of them. These are placed by mental health. They're state clients only. I got into it partly because I have a background in psychology. I've been a counselor. I've worked in the state hospital. And I have a brother who's schizophrenic. He has been in some, I have some terrible language to say it, some awful holes of places in California. I thought I could provide a better place. So far, I've been able to. At this point, there's some problems, though. Insurance costs have risen sharply. For example, Superior Underwriters provided property and liability insurance for me in 1995 for a year. Premium was $841.50.
What was the limit on that?
What's that?
What limits did you have?
Oh, let's see. I think at that time it was $500,000. It wasn't a large policy. By 1999, it was difficult to get any insurance, and when I did get insurance, it was for about $1,400. This last year, I was informed I'd be dropped yet again, and it's always the same reason. You have mentally ill people who essentially are not duct taped to the beds. They can move. They get to have the freedoms of being United States citizens and walk around the community. We don't insure that. Anyway, the premium quoted was a mere $8,000. I earned $4,333 per month in service pay. I get some money for room and board and food. Believe me, it does not cover room and board and food and heating expenses. This pay is to care for 5 adult schizophrenics 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It is impossible to pay this premium and still operate a foster home. I am without liability insurance. To reduce liability, my attorney is setting up a limited liability corporation for the foster home. A knowledgeable insurance agent at ACPO's annual conference just last month indicated the judgments have caused huge increases in premiums, large judgments, I guess, and that insurance companies are refusing to insure any foster home that has both male and female residents in the same home or homes that have mentally ill residents.
Mr. Chair, could you give me an example of the type of judgments we're talking about?
I don't know. Personally, I haven't seen them in the paper. Perhaps
you can do that. I
can tell you there was two judges.
We need you to introduce yourself before you can speak, please.
My name is Harry Geislinger, and I'm a licensed nursing home administrator, and I also own a residential care facility and a nursing home. Those judgments were in, if I recall right, were in California and in Texas. They were between $200 million and $300 million.
And what was?
They were for negligence.
Just as a segue, there was a study done, I can't remember what the gal's name was, but where she, for Oregon, foster homes, comparing foster homes, assisted living, and nursing homes, foster homes have a lower incident
of problems and fewer write-ups by inspecting agencies. And they have a much higher ratio of caregiver to resident to disabled people. You can only have 5 in a home. In any case, I've been canceled at least 4 times. I've actually lost count because I have mentally ill disabled adults in my home. And I can get you a copy of policies that have said it does not meet underwriting guidelines due to mentally handicapped residents ages 25 to 40. Mentally ill adults comprise 100% of those disabled adults in mental health places placed into foster care. Mental illness is evident in a high percentage of disabled seniors placed in foster homes monitored by the Division of Seniors and People with Disabilities. Mental illness is common for veterans who are placed in foster care. If Oregon allows insurance companies to exclude coverage for any foster home with even one mentally ill resident, I envision no coverage for any foster home, and I would add any other care facility. Since the vast majority of healthy, generally normal adults, us in this room, will have a diagnosable mental problem at some point in our life. I say that because I have a doctorate in clinical psychology. I know what I'm talking about. I know how to use the DSM 3-4, et cetera, manuals. That since it's going to affect anybody, the insurance companies could essentially exempt any of us from being covered. In terms of assaults, there are more assaults by disabled seniors with organic brain damage than by diagnosed mentally ill. Will insurance companies refuse in the not-so-distant future to insure those who care for Alzheimer's or pulmonary or heart patients? Please realize that heart or pulmonary patients often have TIAs or transient ischemic attacks that causes brain damage. Their impulse control, their judgment systems are often impaired, so there's a higher frequency of assaults for those people. Are they mentally disabled? Shall they be excluded from insurance coverage? Our disabled deserve treatment in their state of residence, Oregon. Current trends will force placement of mentally disabled adults into much more expensive nursing homes. Foster care is the lowest cost option we have in Oregon. But foster homes are decreasing in number. We have lost, 30% in the last 2 years has been a decrease in foster homes. Anyway, they're likely to be placed, we'll have to reopen mental hospitals. We may have to ship them out of state, apply bus therapy, which was used for a while in the 60s and 70s. Now, I don't have a solution to the current insurance crisis. I do want to help ensure that Oregon's disabled, especially those who have mental problems, will continue to have facilities that can help feed, medicate, bathe, keep them clean and safe in the least restrictive environment, which goes all the way back to the Landman Petrie Short Act in 1969.
Mr. Chair, I think to supplement this testimony, Harry Geislinger can tell you what is occurring in his establishment, the residential care facility, regarding liability insurance.
Thank you.
Before you begin, you want to wait? Okay. Proceed. I apologize.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for giving me the opportunity today to talk about the insurance crisis that's plaguing the long-term care profession. My name is Harry Geislinger. I'm a licensed nursing home administrator. I'm one of the owners of a 50-bed residential care facility and also a 30-bed nursing home. I've owned these facilities for over 15 years, and they are the residents that reside in those facilities are funded by Medicaid, 90%. Currently, the biggest problem I have in our facilities is trying to pay the large premiums for liability insurance. The total cost for our insurance for our care centers this year is $63,712. Last year, it was $13,208. The general liability and malpractice insurance alone is $51,750. Plus a finance charge of $1,400 because I'm unable to come up with that cash all at one time. Last year, our liability insurance cost us $5,728. That's approximately 1,000% increase in my rates. My property insurance last year was $4,574, and this year it's $5,976, which is a 25% increase. The auto insurance we have for our vans to transport our residents to activities, to shopping, and so forth, last year cost us $2,886. This year it's $5,986, which is approximately a 100% increase. The total cost for our insurance increase this year is $50,504. And obviously, this is putting a real financial strain on my facilities. I've talked to at least 10 insurance brokers about this situation, and they all tell me the same story. It costs the insurance company $50,000 to defend a claim. Therefore, the minimum premium to insure any facility at the present time is $50,000 for liability and malpractice insurance. It doesn't matter if you have 30 beds or 80 beds, the premium's the same. In fact, AIG Insurance Company will not insure a facility for less than $75,000 in premiums. There's at least one insurance company that will not write general liability or malpractice insurance for assisted living facilities in the state of Oregon, they say, because of the aging-in-place concept. They're concerned about the liability of that issue. And in fact, they would rather insure a nursing home than they would assisted living facility, which is a big change in attitude in the last few years. I know of at least one RCF that's paying $1,000 a bed for general liability and malpractice insurance, and three assisted living facilities that are paying the exact same amount, $1,000 a bed. I know of at least three nursing homes at the present time that are unable to purchase general liability and malpractice insurance because either they cannot afford it or an insurance company will not underwrite their facility and insure them. I feel that the only way that the long-term care profession can resolve or can survive this insurance crisis is for the legislature to intervene, either cap the damages on non-economic damages, or some other legislative action that will assure the insurance companies that these awards of $200 and $300 million will not happen in the future. And only then will the general liability and malpractice insurance become affordable to our profession. Again, I thank this committee for the opportunity to discuss the insurance crisis facing the long-term care profession in the state of Oregon. Thank you.
Senator Morissette.
Gary, this is maybe a naive question, but how is mental illness determined? Now, does the Division of Senior Disabled Services who place people in your home determine that they are mentally ill?
Actually, mental health does. Lane County Mental
Health. Lane County Mental Health makes that determination.
Oh, excuse me. Lane County Mental Health is the one that determines whether or not they have a mental illness. And in my case, that means, generally it means that they're so psychotic that even on medication, they cannot maintain themselves in an apartment. And by the time they get to foster care, they were not able to even survive in a RCF because they could not do the small duties that an RCF requires.
Okay. May I follow up? Is that, what about your regular nursing home setting? Is there some determination in terms of mental capacity as you admit people into the nursing home?
Yes, we do have. In fact, the two facilities that I'm part owner in both admit residents that have mental health diagnoses.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Grover, thanks for bringing this to our attention. It's kind of a Me Too sort of thing, and I understand that we are in a crisis, and I know a lot of it is driven by what happens in California. I wasn't aware of Texas, but some of the jury awards recently in California are so far beyond absurd, it's totally boggled the mind. But are you basically saying that the cost of tort insurance is the single greatest factor driving people out of the adult foster care business? And you said there was a 30% decrease. How much of that in your estimation is based on the fact that these costs are spiraling out of control and they can no longer afford to be there?
Mr. Chair and Representative Cruz, this problem is just unfolding and developing right now. In the last year, it's really come to a head, if you will, and we're starting to hear about specific individual cases where the insurance company is saying they're not renewing, or if they are willing to renew, it's a prohibitive price. So we have had our leadership calling other members of the association and say, do you have a similar problem? And they're getting yes, yes, yes. So there's a pattern that is unfolding regarding the unavailability of liability insurance. And so I don't say that that it's really taken its full hold yet so that people are truly going out of business so far, but they're on the threshold and saying, what else can I do? I don't have insurance and I don't want to go bare. I can't afford insurance. I don't want to go bare, or they are canceling my policy. I don't know what to do. So Representative Bates nodded in agreement early on that that's right. We don't know what to do. So I wish I had some definitive answers for you, but I can see this problem becoming more prevalent than even we have known about in the last year.
Okay, so the reduction of adult foster homes by 30% in the last 2 years is a compilation of a lot of factors, and this is just going to exacerbate it to the point where we adult foster homes, if we don't do something, may become a thing of the past in the state of Oregon. Is that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Cruz, I believe that's an accurate analysis of what we're faced with. It's a pretty severe type of situation. Senator Morissette asked me before the meeting, basically, well, what can you do? What are you proposing? So I didn't have any real full answer on that, but on the way down here this morning, I thought, well, here is an approach. Maybe a wild idea. But if we were to go back 3 years and assess the cost of liability insurance, we'll say, in the foster home industry, and determine the average cost, and then say the state would say, all right, we will allow the insurance rate to go up, we'll say, 20% a year in the future. And the amount over a 20% increase would be offset by increasing the Medicaid reimbursement rate to those providers who take care of Medicaid residents, which is the vast majority. Now, 60% of the Medicaid rate is paid by the federal government. So we're looking at a 40% downside of this concept. It's a wild idea, but at least it's an idea. And it has some merit because it would get the insurance division aggressively involved with policing the policies and administering the insurance program in the state and trying to assure that there is coverage available and holding down the rates wherever possible. I think it would be healthy to do that.
But Grover, isn't that somewhat of a Band-Aid? I mean, clearly the issue is judgments. I mean, that's driving the rates, and so if all we're doing is, well, we'll just take more Medicaid and general fund dollars to augment this, we're just putting a Band-Aid that in this, at this particular point in time with the budget of the state of Oregon, I'm not sure we can afford. So I mean, clearly isn't the lack of caps in the system what's really driving this?
Mr. Chair, I think proves tort reform is we've all been there for years on end and been unsuccessful in capping those damages through a legislative solution of tort reform. So I was just taking a second approach, which might be more attainable than tort reform.
Well, but Grover, I would submit that we are reaching a crisis point in this state. If we're losing adult foster homes, we're losing anybody in the state who will be willing to deliver babies. I mean, it's going across the spectrum. So I think the prudent approach would be to attack this problem directly rather than to try to put Band-Aids.
There is another industry, too, I became aware of, the whole construction industry. Their insurance has skyrocketed. I mean, it doesn't matter where you look.
Yeah, we are hoping that we can get some federal relief on that if they can get some terrorist standards in place in the insurance industry at the federal level. That might take care of construction. But I think for the medical side, we may have to deal with that at the state level.
Mr. Chair, your willingness to address this thing head-on is really encouraging. Thank you for those remarks.
Representative Bates.
Just a couple of remarks, a few questions. States that have caps on pain and suffering for physicians for Med-Mal are not facing a insurance crisis at this time. The states that don't are. That's straightforward and simple, and it's pretty obvious. What is the situation for nursing homes and extended care facilities and ELFs and foster homes? Are they in the same situation, or are they being driven across the board? If you don't know the answer, it's okay.
I don't know.
Okay. That's something I'd like to find out, because it's a key question, okay? If, you know, if you put, we were managed to get caps in the state as an example and it didn't affect you, then we still have a problem. I mean, the big issues right now are happening in Texas and California, but they're driving rates up across the country because of the fear that's going to hit everywhere. And we need to know if that fear is based on the idea there are no caps or based on the fact that we're going to try to spread the premium across the entire United States. And that's a key question for us to know how to attack this. The second thing we might think about is the medical profession is looking at the type of immunity that is offered to physicians at OHSU. And to see that can be extended to anyone who takes care of Medicaid patients. And that kind of extension potentially legally could be extended to, on a temporary basis at least, to extended care facilities and nursing homes that exclusively take care of Medicaid patients. That's presently being challenged in court. We may lose it, so it may not be a long-term solution. But that's one we should explore also, I'd suggest. And if you're not aware of it, you should explore it.
All of that sounds very encouraging.
But whether it can be done or not is the question. The third point is our basis for care for people in the state that are on Medicaid and other programs is very unusual in the United States. We have a vast network of foster homes and alternate living facilities that reduces the cost of the state in comparison to extended care facilities, which are about three times more expensive, and gives a better quality of life for those people. Mm-hmm. If we start shifting people out of foster homes and out of ELFs, I expect they're going to go into extended care facilities. And Senator Fisher probably knows this better than I do what that cost is going to be like to the state. So we need to address this problem not only to keep you in business, but to keep costs down for the state and to offer a better quality of life for those people.
Mr. Chair. Senator Fisher.
Yeah, I'd have some comments on this whole thing, and it's been extremely frustrating to me because as these costs have been going up, and we've seen this 30% decline, this 30% decline is largely based on the rate that the state pays. People, if they had enough money to be able to hire help to take care of them, give themselves reasonable vacations and things like that so that they can get some time off from these things, recognize that these are homes lots of times where the people live there in residence. They have these people with them 24 hours a day, all year long, and basically no time off. Now, I'm not saying that they're all financial geniuses by a long shot. I've seen several of them that certainly weren't. All they looked at was, as you wrote over here, that $4,333.84, was it, or whatever, was for per patient. And that's exactly the way they looked at it. They thought, my goodness, I can make $20,000 a month on here. There's no way I can possibly spend all this money. And they don't even stop to think about all the problems they face, all the licenses they have to get, all the problems they have, the help that they have to do, the payroll taxes that they have to upfront, and all this kind of stuff. And consequently, after a couple, 3 years at this, they're totally burnt out. And if they haven't got some type of a lawsuit or problems against them where they go up against the state and they're the perpetrator and maligned and every other kind of thing in the process of a state investigation, and frankly they just get tired and sick of it and they can no longer afford it and they quit. This is just adding another point of a sword at their back. urging them out at the quickest possible opportunity. And it's very, very frustrating to me, especially to note that I don't know of any type of care that the state is involved in giving, and the state has its own mental health group homes and things like that where they take care of the same person. I will wage my entire month's salary, my largest salary from the state of Oregon for the position I hold, that there is no state form of care that takes care of the same resident that person takes care of that doesn't get double and sometimes almost triple the same amount as those folks are being given, and they don't have to pay the insurance, and they don't have to pay property tax, and they don't have this and that and the other that we have faced in the private sector. And this is the thing that's always ground me, that we then can't even protect these people. I know of assisted living facility that could not handle a particular patient, and the state backed them up in it, but they're the ones that got sued because they wouldn't take the patient, and the patient had to move. This is utterly ridiculous. I mean, a person has to by license. I have to know, as a licensed caregiver, what I can take care of and what I can. And when I reach the limit of my ability, I pass that on to somebody else who's more capable of taking care of it. By law, I have to do that, or else I'm fined like crazy. And when somebody does that, and then they're subject to a lawsuit, you know, this is just crazy. It's no wonder liability rates and stuff like that are way high. And you try to fight something like that, and the fight is 90% of the problem. And that's why insurance companies cave in, because they don't want to put $40,000 or $50,000 in fighting something that they wind up and lose anyway. And it's just, you know, we have no responsibility whatsoever on the tort end of things for anything that they cause or create. And we've got to get a handle on some of that kind of stuff, and it just boggles my mind. It's bad enough. I thought insurance was bad in my day, and I had 435 bids, and was paying the same amount that a gal had 47 bed home in Portland. I was a stick built home, which is more fire of a fire problem. Hers was a cement block building. But she didn't have the buying power I had at that time. She was paying the same amount for 47 beds that I was paying for 435 beds in three locations. And those are the kind of things that, you know, are just absolutely crazy within our system. There ought to be some type of way of, and I'm not saying, you know, again, that the only case that I ever had a situation was that the insurance company fought it because it was a stupid case. We had a split jury decision on it, but it wasn't split enough. One more, you know, and had been thrown out. The court cut down the award and in half, and it was a situation where somebody suffered some pain, but I had to be negligent in order for that person to get anything. I wasn't negligent, he got nothing. The insurance company fought it, and I still to this day maintain I wasn't negligent. My equipment exceeded what was demanded at that time by law, and because some of that stuff that exceeded it went haywire without being visible on the outside, I'm sitting there in the hot seat for three solid years trying to get this thing to court and get it behind me, and my insurance company wound up and paid, and at that time, you know, it's ridiculous, but they paid about $4,900 at that point in time. This has been 40 years ago nearly, and they wound up paying another about $4,900 when they got all done with the expenses. They couldn't technically afford to fight that. They just well caved in and paid them double to begin with and got it out of their hair. Well, that's not right either, because then you don't have any chance to go through the process and see whether the process really works or not. And this is a frustrating thing about being in business and being involved in liability, because you're out there basically, you talk about going bare, you're bare anyway. You just don't know it. You got the transparent raincoat on, you think you're covered, and you're not.
But you got the bills.
Yeah.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the adult foster home industry, including our association, we don't have the funding to contest these cases in a court of law. We'll just have to take our lumps and go out of business, et cetera. I don't think you'll see expensive litigation coming out of our group. They don't have the money going in. Anyway, thank you very much.
Any other questions from the committee? Mr. Lane, what's the most common issue that lawsuits are filed over involving adult foster home care?
Well, you're covering all the foster homes there. And
just based on your own knowledge of
yeah.
I'm just trying to get an idea of...
Administration of medication, if that's screwed up, somebody not getting to a doctor in time, pain management can be there, unsanitary conditions if somebody is... And that's a concern I have. A lot of foster care providers are... I'm at the young end of the range. And as you get older, sometimes your ability to keep up with things goes, and nobody knows it until, you know, the conditions in the home have deteriorated. I mean, that could, we've all seen it with our own parents or grandparents.
Mm-hmm.
In mental health, some of the lawsuits I'm aware of were unfortunate things where someone got too depressed and went to a neighbor's house and doused themselves with gasoline. You know, so in one sense, see, these are 100% citizens that can roam around the city at any time of day and night. On the other hand, if they do something, then they're suddenly, I was supposed to have a leash on them, but I'd better not have one. So it's the same kind of catch-22 that Senator Fisher was talking about.
I appreciate your answer. Thank you. And Mr. Simmons, if I could ask you... how many liability carriers, insurance-wise, are there available in Oregon right now?
The only answer I'm sure of, Mr. Chairman, is not many. We have the
And they're
team.
Dwindling rapidly, right?
They are. Red Shield was the principal carrier, and they, I understand, have gone out of business, and they have a Rainier insurance company in Washington State is one way or another kind of succeeding Red Shield, picking up some of that business, and some of our members are getting insurance with Rainier, I understand. And then there are two or three others who have come to my attention through the leadership of the association who are they're not licensed in Oregon. What's the term I'm looking for? They are they're not admitted carriers. They're surplus lines carriers. I'm not an insurance agent, but the surplus lines industry apparently is doing a good bit of coverage in Oregon. But those companies, out-of-state companies, are not licensed in Oregon. If I'm reading Rick's summary, as a matter of fact. There's some discussion about that in the paperwork that you were handed out. So the surplus lines carriers are providing the insurance to the industry, but there are not many at all which are available. And then when one principal one goes out of business, you have this truly difficult situation.
And Grange went out of business also. Grange is another one that went out of business.
Oh, yeah.
Gentlemen, thank you for your testimony this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're moving to our 10:30 agenda, Kitty Piercy.
God, you're good.
Bobby Weber.
I say you're really good.
I am. Well, I'm sticking to this thing. Yeah, trying to. Thanks. Thanks, Bill.
Craig Campbell.
And Craig Campbell. Didn't see you sneak in, Craig. Sorry. Apologize. Aha. Good morning.
Good morning.
And welcome.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we were hoping to have Representative Lori Moniz Anderson here. She's coming down. She was going to sort of launch this conversation, so if we could just wait a couple seconds for her to get here.
Certainly.
Thank you.
Kind of put us off schedule. We're right on time. I don't know. I don't think we ought to wait. I think we ought to move ahead.
Tell you what we'll do. We'll take about a three-minute recess. And return at that time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We're putting in schedule, and now we have to do this.